following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Lumpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So I understand we're ready for All of the Above, the title of the show, All of the Above with Norman Lear. I have checked my wallet. I am Norman Lear. I have several great credit cards and a driver's license and all the proof in the world that I am who I tell you I am. And I'm sitting with Paul Hipp, my sidekick, and half of this giant enterprise.
Hi, Norman.
Oh, he is here.
Yeah. So we're not waiting for it to start. We've started.
Hello, Paul.
We're underway.
We can't be seen, but we can be imagined.
We can be imagined. Yes. You should see us, though. We look good.
You look good, particularly good.
Yeah, no, you look amazing.
Well, that's because I'm waving you on.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to talk to a couple of foodies.
Yeah, this is a first for us.
Great men in the food. You know what I know about all of you who are listening? You're probably eating, let me see, 1, 2, 3 meals a day.
Mm.
And in my home, we call them breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Wow.
I don't know what other people call
them. You can
them.
See that out there. You're a seer
yeah.
of things.
And one of the – they're coming in now.
Oh, here they are.
Oh, my God.
This
look
is
at this.
Exciting.
Bruce and Chris.
Hello.
Well, they look well-fed and happy.
I so, would say happy, yes.
We have Chris Brugler. Am I pronouncing it correctly?
That's correct.
And Bruce –
Bazzi.
Bazzi. I wasn't sure of the
right.
Bazzi.
Bazzi.
Bazzi. Bozzi.
Bozzi. Bozzi, like Sir Alfred Douglas.
Bazzi.
That was an Oscar Wilde reference
for
all the theater.
So, Bruce, you own or run the Palm restaurants.
I do. My great-grandfather started the Palm in New York City in 1926, and I'm the fourth generation of the two families, the Ganzi-Bazzi family, to continue the family tradition of running the restaurant.
The Ganzi-Bazzi family sounds like a...
you don't want to
that
mess
sounds like
you
a
don't eat the steak,
that
girl.
A mafioso sound. I don't know what went.
You're going to sleep with the fishes.
You're going to eat the steak or you're going to end up...
But your great-grandfather started the business that you continued.
He did. P.O. Bazzi and John Ganzi came to America in 1913, 1915, and in 1926 on 2nd Avenue and 44th Street. Started the Palm.
Wow.
Yeah. I was 4 years old.
Wow. I mean, come on.
I was amazing. 4 years old when the Palm restaurant started, and they wouldn't let me in.
That's changed.
What was that address again?
The original was on 2nd Avenue between 44th and 45th Street.
Oh,
Manhattan.
Crying.
Yeah.
Wow,
and
that's amazing.
Yeah, and it was there for one restaurant until 1972, and my father and his partner started to expand. But if you think about it, that one joint on 2nd Avenue saw so much of life, you know, the 50s,
oh,
the
yes.
40s, the Great Depression, World War II. It's and this these two fam- this it's just a million stories. It's a great place.
And how many Palm and the Palm here has been an institution for me personally.
Thank you.
My photograph is in the Palm because there are, for those of you who don't know, hundreds of photographs of people.
Yes. We have caricatures
and caricatures,
right,
but
exactly.
I think. Is mine a photograph or a caricature?
You could have had both. I mean,
like Sardi's has in New York.
Yeah, in the 30s in New York, the Palm was in an area where there were a lot of syndicates, a lot of newspapers. So at the time, the guys couldn't afford to pay for their meals, and my great grandfather and John said, just draw something on the walls. And it was caricatures of customers and great cartoonists of the time.
Right.
And eventually it became sort of a rivet. And so Mr. Lear's face is up on the wall.
Oh, that's great.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I remember when that happened. I had gone to lunch there once, and it was, and I couldn't believe there was my photograph. And they seated me under it or near it or where I could see it.
I'm on the wall at Sardi's. And I asked Vincent Sardi once, remember, did you know Vincent? And he said, people will call sometimes and say, can you put my picture downstairs in the main dining room? I'm coming in at 8 o'clock. So, of course, that's what I do now every time
I go. Of course.
And Chris and Bruce, Chris, did you know Bruce before this?
No. We met about 30 minutes ago in the lobby.
In your gorgeous lobby.
I came in a little later than that, and you seem to be very good friends.
Yeah.
Already.
Fellow East Coasters.
You know what it is? It's you're easy smilers, both of them.
Oh, yeah. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah. And so you are?
I have a catering company, Chris Brugler Catering.
Yes, and you're a major chef.
Yes. Thank you.
I sit in awe of great chefs.
Me too. You?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I should know that you're not real fat.
I'm always hustling. I'm always running around.
Yeah, burning it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And only eat two meals a day. Don't have time for the third, which I got to start doing to get to look like.
You're a young man. You're not 40 yet, are you?
I just turned 40.
You just turned
August,
40.
August, yeah.
Happy birthday.
Norman didn't say that to me, but I'm in my 50s.
Well, you turned 40. I knew when you turned 40. It was 3 days ago.
I turned 40 in a couple of years. When do you turn 40?
I turned 40. Can you fucking believe I turned 40 55 years ago?
Wow. I'm going to be 55. So when I was born.
So you have 40 years to catch up with me.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Wow. It's amazing.
Do you think I believe it for a split second?
I bet you don't.
I have to say it because it is the truth.
And with a new TV show just wrapped. Can I say that? A new pilot.
Oh, yeah. It's a new pilot called Guess Who Died.
Yeah.
About people in the vicinity of my age living in a retirement village.
Yeah.
In Florida.
In Florida, where I just came from because I was attending a retreat of people for the American Way.
Okay. Did you just give us a fun fact about a retirement home
yes,
in Florida?
He did. We're being quiet
Before we went on the air, Norman gave a fun fact, and I'm putting him on the spot to tell you, America.
The fun fact, I don't know the name of the retirement village. It's a retirement village where people are moving about in golf carts. That's where we had our retreat, not in the golf, but with lots of golf carts.
Yeah.
And White Oak, we had our retreat, for those of you who know Florida. And but there is a retirement village in Florida where the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases is at a high. I mean, the high point in America, if one is looking for a location where there is more sexually transmitted, it is this retirement village in Florida.
That is so life-affirming.
Oh, it is.
It really is.
It's like people are still doing it. But I want to know how the STDs get into any retirement village. Who's a carrier?
One bad girl or bad guy, they come in, they're like, hey, I'm here, let's get going.
The clap is all around.
They roll into there, and then the next thing you know.
Wow.
Well, I don't know. Since I don't know anything about it except that statistic.
Will you work that into the show, that factoid?
Yes.
That's of course.
I mean, this is just a pilot. We have to see if it's picked up. If it's picked up, yes.
Wait, God has something Norman, to say. God wants to tell us something.
Remember, our show takes place in Palm Springs, not Florida.
Did I say it takes place in? I didn't say
I heard there was some Florida mumbling prior.
He said Palm Springs.
Oh.
Palm Springs.
Yeah. So one might think from the conversation preceding that our show takes place in Florida. It doesn't. I just went to Florida for a retreat for an organization I started. The show takes place in Palm Springs.
Palm Springs, right. Yes. The Palm.
And because it takes place in Palm Springs, we so shot fitting. It in Thousand Oaks.
Nothing is real.
Really, the capital
fake news.
STDs.
Fake news. So, when did you know, Chris, that you wanted to cook, that you were a chef?
Probably when I was a sophomore in high school. I went to an all boys Catholic school.
I did.
Oh, brutal, right?
Yeah, totally.
And then my first job was actually at a retired nun's home that was next door to the school. So when I was done working or done going to school, I would go over there and, you know, work the late night shift kind of thing.
STDs.
And
then,
not that I knew of then. and started kind of falling in love with it through that way. And then went to school, finished up high school, and then right from high school went to the restaurant school in Philadelphia. And then went right to the Ritz-Carlton, Philly.
What school did you go to?
It's called the restaurant school.
No, I mean high school.
Oh, Father Judge.
I went to Wood.
Oh my gosh, you're kidding me.
And yeah. you played each other.
In football for sure. Yeah,
we
sure.
played football against Judge.
Yeah. I'm Father Judge.
This is really happening?
This is insane.
Yeah. Wow. I'm from Warminster in the house.
They are reaching across the table and touched palms.
Eagles.
Palms.
And touched
Eagles,
palms.
Yeah.
There you
palms again.
The other palm reference.
Palm Springs, touch palms.
And the man who owns the palms is also here.
STDs.
STDs.
Palms.
Someone to read our palms.
So tell us about these two high schools and the...
The Philadelphia
Diocese. We both grew up not far from each other. I'm in Bucks County.
Yeah, probably 20 minutes maybe.
So I went to an all-boys Catholic school. For three of the 4 years, they asked me to leave for 1 year. But I went to Archbishop Wood. And incidentally, what if Archbishop Wood had become the Pope? For the rest, we call him Pope, whatever, but the rest of the world calls him Papa. Papa Wood.
Papa Wood.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway, so yeah, we were sort of rivals. I mean, yeah. Judge was one of the teams we played. So there you go, the local color.
Which team was better?
Depends on what year, I think.
Yeah,
I
mean, and I'm so old, and I was so high, I don't really care.
He wasn't playing on the team.
Under the bleachers. With a guitar and a girl, hopefully.
That's
amazing. So from Philadelphia, so when did you come out here?
I came, when did I come out here? 2001. I was working at the Ritz-Carlton Atlanta Buckhead at the time, and then September 11th happened, business travel, hotel. Everything kind of just went to shit. So I actually got out of cooking. I have a lot of friends in finance that were trading in San Francisco. So they were like, why don't you come be a clerk? And you can kind of just take time off from cooking. Because I was working with like crazy French chefs who were full on. So I actually got out of cooking for 2 years and was like, okay, well, I can't trade. This isn't for me. Partied a little bit, kind of did my 2-3 years of that because I didn't go – I went right from high school to working like 12, 15 hours a day. And then light went off one day and I realized that all the traders were flying people in from New York, London, et cetera, and they were entertaining. So I started marketing to do dinner parties. So I literally had I was the only one cornering the market. So I started doing dinner parties for all the traders on the floor, and that's really when the love – was reignited because I was so deflated from working with these, you know, crazy
Why
chefs.
Were they tyrannical?
I mean, they're like Gordon Ramsay on steroids. Like Gordon Ramsay's show, it is reality how that is with a lot of the great chefs. Like I did an event with the chef from the Ritz-Carlton Atlanta, and it was a Paul Bocuse charity event. And at the end of it, like
Paul Bocuse is perhaps the best known of chefs across the globe.
Exactly. Yeah, he's a living legend. So that's the kind of caliber this chef that I was working with trained under Paul for like 15 years. So it was just full on, and I needed a break and then realized that I had this great opportunity. So I started doing a lot of private dinner parties and then got a private chef job for a family in Montecito. And then did Montecito for a year and then down to L.A. and worked for families in Beverly Hills for like 5 years.
Did you ever do a meal for a family or an event and you were disappointed in the meal?
Yeah. I mean...
What's the worst meal you ever cooked?
Well, Jesus, that's a tough one.
That many, huh?
Yeah. I'm already up to 100. I don't know about One of the toughest ones when I was working for a gentleman who used to be a big wig at Disney, and he was involved with Tata Motors when he came over to buy Jaguar and stuff. So they came over with like, it was like 12 men from India sitting around this table, and they wanted to do like an Indian-inspired
dinner. The table.
Oh, sorry. So basically I did my twist on it, and it was a huge success. So that was one of the most challenging ones. But I would say being a private chef, you can have a lot of dinners that you're not necessarily that excited about, in the sense when you have kids. We were talking about it earlier. You know, the kids need to eat at 6 o'clock. The mom and dad have 20 minutes to eat. It's literally like a restaurant. You're feeding one kid because he has to go off. There's another kid. It's like they don't always sit down together at the same time. So that was one of the challenges.
Well, that's when you're cooking for a family, not for an event a family home.
Right. Correct. Yeah. That's more on the private chef level.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does word go out from the families like, this guy's really good, and then you start doing events? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, when you play in the circle of the people that we were talking about, you know, live in Beverly Hills, they're a lot of their friends are obviously influential who do galas and things like that. And it's just a slow build of having your reputation from, you know, the front of the house with the servers. It's just important as the food. I mean, it's a whole package. And especially when you get into catering, it's more than just the food and the service, because there's, you know, if you work at some people's home, they have estates, there's guard gates, like instructions to deal with. There's certain load in procedures. When you work at Disney or places like that, there's certain times you have to be there. So with catering, it's a whole other animal than a restaurant. As far as I would say logistics.
Yeah.
So that can be a very, you know, I love that though, because each event's different. It's a rush for me.
Right.
So.
Right. And gotcha. Bruce, you have in your time, you've nurtured a lot of chefs.
We have. We've had a lot of chefs come and go. At one point, we had 30 restaurants, but we've scaled back.
Wow.
But, you know,
there were 30 Palms?
30 Palms.
And today, as we sit here?
There's 22.
22.
Yeah. You know, but things change, markets change, stuff like that. But to Chris's point, the... you know, you're managing a group of people. The experience is the same, but also going to be different every night. But it's challenging. It is a challenging managing chefs and line cooks and that whole back of the house is, you know.
You know what I think of often as the most challenging is ordering the food that you're going to cook. I mean, the bigger the restaurant, the more I think of, my God, how do they know how many celery stalks?
Yeah.
It's a fun one. That's a good – yeah, I don't think about that anymore because we're in it. But, yeah, you think, how do you know how many steaks to order, you know, or what produce?
Yeah.
You kind of do the flow of your business. So you see what reservations – you kind of have – you get a rhythm of knowing your business and your top-line sales so you can order stuff so it doesn't go to waste. Or if you see it's going to go to waste – you push it through. So you sort of say, okay, incentivize your staff to sell stuff.
Right.
Is the Palm in
the other location? I know the Palm in New York. I know the Palm here.
Yes.
And maybe I have visited a Palm or two in other cities. I don't remember at the moment. But does the Palm in each city where it's located have the same unique kind of reputation that the Palm has, for example, here? And
I think it does. It's LA. We found that a lot of people think their Palm in their city was the first Palm, which I think
that's good.
Let them think it.
Oh, okay. Because one of the, you know, how we've expanded is all about the relationships we have. So, you know, in each city, it's very unique and specific. So you try to, at one point, we had to standardize everything and make everything consistent. So when you were in those cities, you knew you were in a Palm. It smelled like a Palm. It tasted like a Palm. But you also wanted all the nuances to be specific to that city, because it's really, we look at them as local restaurants. Mm. So, yes, it's important.
So let me ask you, here we have photographs and caricatures of well-known people.
Yes.
In other cities, are there photographs?
The faces stay. People walk into the Palm and they're like,
I mean, does Milty Ferguson own or deserve a photograph?
It's people that go into that restaurant. So it's, you know, we establish a relationship and I want to celebrate the relationship. Bam, your face is on the wall. Yeah. Another is local celebrities, you know, government mayors, governors. And then there's sort of like the movie stars that do kind of travel on about.
Yeah.
You know, we try to make it as authentic as possible. So if you haven't been in that restaurant, your face isn't up. You know, we just don't throw up a face because it's, you know, we want it to be real. But Yeah, I mean, it's. I always think it's kind of a weird thing, but people love it. Like, I wonder what people think when they've never been to a palm. They walk into this restaurant, and all these faces are just staring at them. You know, it's like.
Well, I think it's famous enough that people kind of get it right away. Kind of, it's a homey kind of thing too. Yeah. Like, these are the faces of the people that inhabit this joint. Welcome.
Right. Yeah, and it's a joint.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
And many the faces who used to inhabit a good many years ago.
It's a time capsule. It is a time capsule. Yeah. The Palm doesn't stay the same. Like, so, in 1975 when we opened up in West Hollywood, it was very different. 40 years later, you know, you're like, wow.
Well, let me ask Chris and Paul. Eating at the Palm looks good on him, doesn't it?
I was going to say, how do you stay in such...
I mean, he's a... In Yiddish, we call him a shtaka.
A shtaka. I like it.
That means a strong man.
Okay.
Yeah, you're like a walking advertisement for the good benefits of eating a good steak for your protein.
At the Palm.
For those listening at home, he's very muscular.
Yes, he's the man is wearing a simple T-shirt, I mean, or a sweater shirt or something.
Yes.
It's, you know, I mean, we don't dress to come to this microphone. But he's got two of the arms that...
God, I feel good being in here.
He doesn't deliberately show a muscle, and yet they're showing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you're trying.
See? They're screaming.
Steak is good. A lot of protein.
Yeah, but you skip the like, is it just a steak and a potato with nothing on it? You skip the cream cheese and all the stuff, or the sour cream, I mean. And
the older I got, yes, I'm more protein vegetable. I believe in a carb. I'm not one of those people that don't believe in carb. But
you have this cream spinach?
I'm not a big cream spinach guy. Yeah.
Right.
That kind of stuff I avoid.
And you skip the pie at the end.
I skip the pie, but I'll drink a lot of the booze.
Have the booze. Do you have
so
a...
Oh, yes.
That is where I make up for.
What's your favorite drink?
My favorite drink would be anything tequila-based. I love tequila.
Tequila.
Or a red wine. Really great red wine.
Yeah. Do you ever, after a nice steak and potato, do you ever have a nice Cuban cigar?
No, you know what? I try. I used to just want to barf after I had a cigar. I inhaled it. It just made me always nauseous.
Don't inhale.
Yeah, you're talking to two guys who believe that if there was no other reason to believe in God, it would be Havana leaf.
This is true.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have a cigar every day?
No. But I have a cigar every several weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And these years I have it with Paul and about 10 other guys. All of them. Paul's a great musician, singer, and everything else. He made his reputation in a show on Broadway, which was...
Buddy Holly.
Okay. And so he sings and plays the guitar, as do these guys largely from Concord Records. And
our buddies that hang with us.
Awesome. And we will do as often as we can, it amounts to every 5 weeks or so, a dinner with great wines.
Right.
Catered.
Where a conversation goes... The conversation between the chef and the guy who knows these wines like nobody I've ever met before, they take 3 days talking about mixing the wines and the food, and then we have that dinner and hear about the... It's a romance.
Yeah.
It really is a romance. Hearing about wine and what it means with the food and then we go out and smoke Cuban cigars. Right.
And play music.
And play music until 1 or 2 in the morning.
Just howling at the moon.
I mean, I think that's the secret, is moderation and also passion and enjoyment. Like, you mix – that's the beauty, I think, of what Chris and I do, is we facilitate people to come together and experience something that's magical, which is what I most enjoy about working in the restaurant business, is that you see people celebrate life together. And that, and I think your testament, I mean, you were 4 years old when the Palm was born. Everyone here is in amazing shape. What do you think that is the reason? Like,
I love what you just said. I mean, you're watching people who've come together to have a good time.
Yeah.
To have a good meal.
Yeah. Mm.
Except for those families where 3 kids are on a cell phone.
Yeah.
And an iPad.
And the father is barking at the waiter.
And there are more and more of them.
While he has his cell phone on hold over here.
It is insane to look at a table of 5 people and then none of them are looking at each other. They're all looking at their phone.
It happens more and more. It's just I saw dad and son walking from the promenade the other day, and I thought, what a nice tableau. And as I got up, I realized they were both on their phones, and it was a little kid.
Wow.
You know, so there's a magic moment lost to the phone. How many of those?
Yeah. It's true.
So you think about that at your restaurants?
Yeah, I've seen.
Too much of the cell phone.
Too much of the cell phone. People sitting. The actual dining experience is we've added on about another 30 minutes because where it used to be about 90 minutes, it's about 120 with because now people sit there and they're very content just sitting there communicating with other people who are far away rather than the person that they're sitting next to.
Wow.
And they just sit there. So when you need the table, like if you're busy, you're like, you know, shit.
30 minutes.
Yeah. We need the table. Yeah. Like, but, yeah.
We have to turn this.
This is a business. Now,
I want to make a suggestion to you. Mm-hmm. Try this in one of 22 Palms.
Okay.
No cell phones.
Yeah.
And see, what do you think, what can you imagine would happen if you barred cell phones?
I think it's well worth the try. I think people are right now really starting to freak out about how addicted we all find ourselves to these things and freaking out. But you're so addicted to the bottom level of your mind. You know, you don't have to think anymore. People don't know how to get off it. It's literally, as bad as crack or heroin, anything that's out there. And we're going to look, but there is going to be a time where we reflect back on this and people are going to be like, that's how you interacted? I mean, I'm looking at you, Norman, a man who wrote the most prolific shows that I grew up with. And it was all about people talking to each other, all about human interaction, social, what was happening in the world. It's sad. So I think it's a great test.
Yeah.
No phones.
And no phones.
No phones.
And an armed phone security man.
Right. People would freak out. They might just, you know, start shaking.
They wouldn't know what to do. They wouldn't know what to do. I can't believe that it adds a full 30 minutes to the dining experience.
It does. That's what we basically watched that grow.
It's incredible.
And it just pisses us off sometimes.
Restaurants are hard work.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
very hard.
Yeah, you guys came up through. You worked your way up in the restaurant.
Yeah, nothing.
You didn't just get dropped in at the top.
No, you worked your way up. I did I worked in the back of the house. I am not a cook, and I am also, I mean, I'd like to cook, but very simple. I can cook you a great steak and some sautéed spinach, but I...
Not cream spinach.
And then we'll all be muscular.
Yeah. I had to work. You don't know it until you walk the walk and you understand the rhythm of the restaurant. So I worked in the back of the house, in the kitchen, on the floor, on all levels of management. And it was expected of me. It was never expected that I wouldn't do that. And I learned so much, not only about what we call the sort of, you know, the internal customer, which is the people I work with, understanding them, but the, you know, how to be with people who come into the restaurant. And that was, I think, that's sort of, if you believe in like the DNA, like you're born with something because it's passed on in you. That is something that I think all my grandfathers, my grandmothers, that's part of knowing how to treat people. And I always say, when you go into a restaurant, like you're not doing me a favor. You know, there are restaurants where and certain chefs, you know, it's like they're really obnoxious because they feel the customer is doing them a favor. It's like, we are here for you and we are here to, you know, and it's, you have to be humble about it and you have to have humility, but you have to also have fun.
Yeah.
It's about having fun so other people have fun. People, you know, they want to go to the restaurant after work because they just want to like let loose. They had a shitty day. Come to the restaurant. They literally, the Palm people come to celebrate life. They celebrate death. People die. We've had more.
And the cell phone interferes with everything you're talking about.
It does.
With the emotion of being together to celebrate something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not completely together.
Is it insulting to the chef to ask for A1?
I think some chefs, yes. I mean, we don't put it. There was a time we don't put it on the table. We have it. I mean, I would say if you have a really great steak, you don't need A1 sauce.
Or anything, right? No.
That's basically the point. Sugar. Yeah. I mean, the chef can answer that better than I, but.
Of course.
I'm along the same lines as Bruce as far as like we're in the customer service industry, first of all. And things have changed so much now where I think a lot of chefs are, it needs to be served this way. It's the only way to eat it where, you know, for my company, we tweak the menu and do whatever you want. And yes, of course, we don't recommend having A1 sauce with a steak, but if a client suggests it, who am I to tell you no? Yeah. Like, my job is to make your experience amazing, so you're going to want to come back.
You're presenting the finished product.
Right, without A1 sauce. But if you want it, of course.
And a ton of salt. People put salt on so, yeah. so much salt on things.
A lot of salt.
Yeah.
And I would think that would make the chef want to cry.
Well, when I worked with the French chef, he was always, you know, he would always actually say stupid Americans, because he was like, why do you want your steak well done? And I just never got it. I'm like, I get it. It should be – it's better. We like it medium rare or rare. But at the end of the day, they're paying your salary. Like, they come into your restaurant and make your restaurant successful.
Right.
If they want it well done, just keep it moving.
Which is ironic because
a lot of chefs are crazy though. Like, the ego is huge.
The French invented all those sauces to cover the fact that it was bad meat. Right. So it's very ironic he's complaining about stupid
Americans. Did you ever see the movie Big Night?
Yes.
It's one
Louis
of the
Tucci.
Best. Yes. Yeah, it's one of the best food
Big Night.
Restaurant. Big Night.
Yeah.
And the chef is – they own this restaurant. Like, no one's going in. Next door, the other restaurant's packed. And his brother's a chef, and he's – and the woman wants, you know, like, chicken parmesan with a side of spaghetti. And he's like, no, I won't. I won't do that. And the brother's like, please, just give her the spaghetti. No, I will not do that. I won't do that. And it's like a huge fight. And he's that kind of chef.
Is
like,
that
very –
Yeah, that's the best restaurant movie ever. Or is
wait,
it?
I have to know how it ended.
The last shot is unbelievable. I don't want to give it away, but
give it away.
No, I can't do it.
It's really
we got to watch.
Great
it.
Movie.
Does he come through? Does
he comes through? There's a whole.
Yeah.
But it's just this whole. It's all about. It's about love. It's about food. It's about passion. And it's about these restaurants. And it's his Stanley Tucci is amazing.
Yeah.
No, you haven't seen. You need to see that. We need to have a screening.
Let's screen that.
Next cigar night,
and we'll get some steaks and
some palm steaks.
Yeah, let's screen
Chris
that during one Cream of these spinach. Podcasts.
And the audience can listen to us comment and eat really good food.
Exactly.
Listen to us eat a good meal and watch a great movie.
And drink some good red wine.
Yeah, that is funny. What other great food movies? What captures it? I worked in the food industry as a busboy for about 3 months. But anyway, there is no harder work.
Career.
The way people work in kitchens and in restaurants, and it's relentless and nonstop.
You have to love it.
Yeah.
I mean,
and it is two worlds going on, because you have what's happening in the front, and then everyone goes in the back, and you're either, you know, screaming at each other, or you're like, that asshole on table 10. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or, oh my God, that person. So it's like these two worlds are happening at the same time.
You know, I wish you wouldn't said that asshole at table 10. Because I was there at table 10.
Yeah, you were a guest of the asshole.
What
you
are the great asshole. Movies? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, the great food movies.
Well, my mind goes to my friend Phil Rosenthal, who is the great foodie on – is he on television or he's on Netflix?
Netflix.
Now.
He's on Netflix.
Yeah. But he is the foodnik of all time. I love eating with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you guys seen Chef's Table on Netflix? It's amazing.
Is it?
Yeah. Some of the baddest chefs.
Is that like, would David Chang have just been on that? Because I just saw one that was great on Netflix.
Yeah. The guy from Momofuku.
Uh-huh.
Also. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, they take you all over the world with the craziest chefs.
It's amazing how much food has become in the forefront of television and movies and what people are really focused in on, I think.
Yeah.
It's sustained us, and it has ever since the human of the species or any other species.
You are the Challah King?
Challah King, yes.
Challah King.
Challah King. Challah King.
I saw you said the ch. That was the year I went to public school. Well, tell us about that.
May I correct you? It's Challah.
I know I messed up. the Challah King?
Challah.
You want to challah about that?
Challah back.
Challah back?
Yeah, I had actually no clue what challah was. I was on a phone interview with my client, soon-to-be client in Beverly Hills, and I was on the computer, and she was I had her on speaker. I was on the computer, and she's like, "Oh, but the last chef made challah." This is what I was telling me about.
Someone famous?
No. So I'm Googling, and up comes this like 10-foot loaf of bread, and I'm like, "Oh shit!" I'm like, "Yeah, sure, we can make that." So I'm like, "Is your oven that big?" And so, long story short, I ended up doing 3 tastings. I got the job, and then about a month into it, every Friday they did Shabbat, but normally it's like family style or buffet. They would literally have like meat flown in from LaBelle's in New York. Like, money wasn't an issue when it came to their food, which was great from a chef standpoint. So the husband was like, "Why don't you try making it?" So started playing around with different recipes and came up with the Challah King of Beverly Hills. And it was funny until the grandmother one year it fell on St. Paddy's Day, so I thought it was going to be good to do. Like, we always did white chocolate, so I found green white chocolate chips. Ooh, damn, that did not go over so well. Really? The kids loved it, but the grandmother was like, "What are you doing? What is this?"
That's great.
So that's kind of how that started. And then I actually brought white chocolate challah bread pudding for you guys as well. So we use it on the menu. For dessert now, and yeah.
Can you give us if this was a show and we were on TV, we would have a cooking demonstration. Can we do an audio cooking? Can you give like a recipe of some kind? Is there something you could throw out there to the listeners and us that gets your pen and paper ready?
Does your challah have the rolling top?
Yeah, so we do the 3-coil braid.
Call it 3-coil?
3 coils. So we roll it into the 3 coils and then we braid it. I'm a pretty good braider.
Wow. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, good braid.
We're learning a lot, the technical lingo and everything.
Yeah.
3-coil braid.
It's difficult. I mean, I don't know if that's what anyone else calls it. That's what I call it.
I'm learning a lot.
Some of them have like 8 to 10 coils. Yeah, we just do the 3.
I didn't know challah was challah. And
does the palm serve a Friday night challah?
No, it does not. Though, the High Holy Days, we'll have matzah and stuff, but no, mm-hmm. we should.
That's what about fish?
I'm a Jew Italian.
You've just met the Challah King.
I know. So.
There we go.
You're doing. Teaching.
So, ladies and gentlemen, I love connecting dots. And we may just have connected the dot of dots. 22 Palm restaurants, which are glorious restaurants.
There we go. Done and done.
Across the country have not had, especially on Friday night, which is the Jewish Sabbath, challah, which is a Jewish delight of a bread. Very special. And the Challah King, the man known to be that.
Yeah, this is a brilliant idea. Yeah,
so maybe we'll see some challah at the Palm.
Let's start this in Beverly Hills.
Shake on it, and I'll photograph it.
Right here.
You'll see that on social media. It's all happening.
With no cell phones.
Oh, my God, the things that can happen in a lifetime.
The things that you have produced, that's the latest Norman Lear production.
You, Bruce.
Yes.
I'm married to a great guy.
I am.
I love him.
Nah, thank you.
Brian Lord is the king, what's the word I want to look for? He's singular as an agent in this town.
He truly is.
And as a mensch.
Yeah.
But he's a man.
Yes.
And so part of this, of our foursome is a fellow who is married to another guy.
Yeah.
And my generation has lived to see this.
Yeah.
I'm so full of feeling about the human of the species when I think about that. Where I was when I was 14 years old and thought about a guy and a guy or a girl and all of that stuff.
Right.
And what has happened over all these years to a place where it's awesome to me. Mm-hmm. I think quickly of where we are racially, and wish to God in that area we would make the kind of advances we've made in this particular area. But
it's amazing. I agree. It's even how I grew up in a very traditional Italian family, growing up in a business that was really a bastion of white heterosexual people that would go to the Palm. I mean, that was. that was our group. So when I started to work for my family, when I came out in the early 90s, I did say to my dad, and all these guys knew me forever, you know, I was, is it okay? If it's not okay, I understand. I'm gay. I'm not. And he was like, it's absolutely okay. You're a good man. And that's what is important. And then, but marriage was certainly never something that I grew up thinking about. That wasn't a word that husbands, that wasn't happening. Children, what, you know?
Yeah.
And to be 52 in 2 weeks and to have a 10-year-old daughter that I did with IVF, with an egg donor and myself, and have that piece of my life, start a family, and to fall in love and marry a man and actually marry him and have my parents at the wedding crying. And I feel like this is an amazing time. And what's also great are like from Ava, who's 10, they don't see or know from the difference from that, how they, you know, talk about or, you know, daddy and Bri Bri, she calls him Bri Bri, her two dads. It's really beautiful, Norman. I agree. I wish on so many levels the world could come together. But that was, together easy. That was a big fight. It was a long road to get from how people thought of gay people to then getting through and the AIDS crisis and what happened with, you know, the gay culture and then to marriage equality. And, you know, it's a
wedge issue not long ago in the election, right, Bush?
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to mention to the people who are listening, those who are listening early on in this conversation, that the guy who's talking and telling this story is the guy we were talking about earlier as having muscles that had muscles. I mean, he's the stock guy I talked about earlier. Yeah.
I love it.
Stocker and Halla.
Stocker and Halla. But it's wondrous that it could come to this place in a single lifetime.
100%. If you think about it, I mean, like, whether it's a, you know, civil rights movement or you know, women voting or everything that has changed, you know, Norman talked about Brian. Brian's my husband. He is a truly magnificent human, and he is a mensch. He is, you know, we all feel fortunate to fall in love with, I think, anybody. But to find love on that level, it's great. And you're right. Yeah. And I never thought I'd have it. It was, you know, it was my secret growing up. It was my, you know, in the 80s, I said recently, you know, when kids smelled gay, they were not nice.
Right.
It was not an easy road to navigate how to, you know, oh, I got to walk down that block because those group of boys are going to, you know, not be nice. You know what I mean? Or, you know, you had to figure out. And now kids hopefully don't have to worry about that. They could just be.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, well, it was a pejorative, right? That's so gay.
Yeah.
He's so gay. Yeah.
He's so gay.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Someone said that recently on I got a response. Oh, Bruce, I remember you before you were so gay. And I said back, well, you might remember me, but you didn't know me because I've always been me. So
I was you,
basically.
I was just as gay then.
Right. Like, honestly.
Well, being at my age, my generation, I feel like I saw it all. I mean, coming out of the darkest place into a little bit of light, a little bit of light, a little bit of light. And then sometime 25 years ago or something, it's, you know, LGBT started to kick ass a little. And shit. I love, in terms of our shows, having been a little part of it.
You're being humble because you took that on.
Well, I'm not being humble. We were being real. I mean, we were doing these things that were, you know, these were family situations and family problems. And anyway.
Yeah, but, you know, I remember growing up and watching All in the Family, and, you know, there were many episodes, but you had – the one episode that always resonated was when Edith Bunker got raped. And that was like – and I was, you know, however old I was and how that was handled. And also the transvestite, I believe, a large guy.
Yes,
and he – I think he got beat up and then he got killed.
He got killed.
And her reaction, I'll never forget that. I mean, I could cry thinking about it now, but that's, you've been bringing that forever. And you, what you didn't know, what I didn't know, that's here in the 70s. I'm 11, 12, 13. I'm coming, you know, I'm growing into that. And I'm watching your shows, and that's sitting with me in a very private place because I'm watching it with my mom and dad, but they're not knowing how they're reacting to that character.
Uh-huh.
I'm feeling something, and I'm feeling it through Edith Bunker's eyes because that was devastating to her, and that was just devastating. And how Archie had it. It was just...
Well, his death was devastating her.
Yeah.
But when she met him, she... You know, we always asked ourselves, what would Jesus do? That's how we developed Edith Bunker's character. What would Jesus do? He loved him.
Right.
And, wow. Oh, God, I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about you.
If you think about the time, there's nothing even close to the same universe as you were in on TV.
Nothing.
In dealing with anything, right? I mean, you know, you were alone in that. Dealing head-on with issues at the time.
But they were issues that we were all living through. I mean, they were up the street, down the street, across the street from each other. I mean, there was some place on the block where the people were dealing with all of these things.
Right, right. Yeah.
So, but you were 7 years old, Bruce, when you were looking at this, and or 8 or 10 or whatever.
Yeah, it was that zone.
And your folks didn't know what you were going through.
No.
And when did you tell them?
I didn't tell. I mean, I think any parent who's paying attention, more my mother than my father, she was aware something was going on, but it was not discussed. I kind of retreated, so I became very much walled off, so nobody could really get in. I wasn't really dating anybody. Every now and then there'd be a girl in my life, but you know, I was just trying to figure it out. I told them in my early 20s. I came back out. I graduated USC, went back to New York. I was a page at NBC for a year, which was a great job. And then I came back to LA, and I was working at the restaurant. But I really came back to go get away from my family in New York and to create a life for myself that had gay friends and I could be and experience. Because at that time, you had a latent adolescence if you were gay. You didn't have it from 13 to 18. You really had it from like 20 to 25 because – you could get away from, and I told them when I was in my early 20s, and you know, there was mixed reviews. My mom was kind of upset, but she quickly saw I was, you know, going to be happy and met somebody that I was in a relationship with. And my dad just always said, I want you to be happy and be a good person. And that's really all that matters. And,
yeah, love it.
Wow. Yeah. Right.
So I was lucky that way.
Let me ask you something, Chris.
Yes.
You met Bruce for the first time here today. So when this came up in this conversation, did you know that he was, I don't want to say gay because I don't think that word works anymore, that he could be married to Brian?
I mean, we spoke a little bit downstairs about our history and me being a private chef and some things like that, and then Brian came up, but I wasn't aware prior or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It took me a while in my life to be able to meet a new person and use the pronoun he, being in a relationship with, or like today. So we were talking about what Chris does, and I said, yeah, my husband and I are, and that still rolls off with a little bit like a little rocky, not because I feel uncomfortable, because it's new. You know, and
it's yes. It's
Can I share new. what I was thinking?
No.
About it?
Go.
Go.
When you said that, my first thought was, wow, his husband sounds like a great agent. I wonder if he could set up a meeting for me.
Smart. He is.
So that's how that's times have changed. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Gay shmay. Huh. Husband is a great agent. That sounds
perfect. Love it.
Hey, Chris, when did you come out?
Chris is happy.
Are you married? Are
yes.
You?
Been married for 9 years.
Children?
Yep, 4-year-old boy.
All right.
Yeah, Oliver is his name.
So now we put together the Hala King and the Palm.
I love it.
There's a lot of stuff. Big things happen on All of the Above with Norman Lear.
Yeah, so what can I tell that's deeply secret in my life?
Here we go. Take your time.
Make it filthy.
I was told that I would go, my father told me that I could go blind masturbating.
Oh my goodness. That's really.
He did.
And you believed it.
And oh my God, I believed it. And
wow.
And I remember that I had wallpaper my bedroom. I had wallpaper I could write on. Nobody would see it because of the way it was designed and marked and so on. So I used to mark on the wallpaper when I did. And every time I had four and the next line would be a through, you know. Through
the cross.
I wanted to kill myself before I went blind.
Oh, and the shame.
Oh, my God. That is hysterical.
Blind and shame.
Here I am. I'm telling this on a podcast. I didn't even. I thought about it and didn't write it in the book.
That's right. Well, you have to do a follow-up. Norman Lear, The Secrets.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's funny.
Wow.
But that's why my bumper sticker reads, "Just Another Version of You."
Yeah.
We are versions of one another. Mm-hmm. And the multiplicity of those versions, my God, that's as miraculous as anything in life.
True.
Because we are all so individual.
Yeah.
Which is to be celebrated. And more is. But there's, it seems that humanity is struggling with these forces. You know, the ones that can't admit that things are as we are all. Versions of each other, and the hopefully winning greater ones that are kind of figuring it out and celebrating it.
I think so. I don't know. It seems like right now there's a lack of generosity going on, or people aren't listening to each other. We were talking, Chris and I, a little bit about this, like looking at LA specifically, and you know, people. For an example, making a U-turn across Sunset Boulevard from the farthest lane possible.
Yeah.
Like this, like it's like they're by themselves, and there's this like world where people are separate and living in their own space, very selfishly. And then I say a lack of generosity because life is complicated right now with a lot of issues that are up, and I feel like people can't listen. They're aggravated. It's bipolarized with. What's happening with Trump, and you know, in the beginning, no one could even have a conversation without completely eviscerating the person you were speaking to, as opposed to trying to understand. And you know, and it's not easy. I'm a liberal Democrat. I get it. Like I have a lot of social issues, but I think it's a challenging time. I mean, as challenging as I think I've ever seen it. And I also said I feel like I'm at a point where I'm aware of life. In a way, when you're alive and you're not aware, you're just living your life. And now I'm aware of it, time and people, and appreciate. It's just
what's important.
Yeah, you know. So it's unfortunate. I would like to see us all come together, be able to listen and not eviscerate people who have made mistakes in their life, and not but have room for people to own it and not. Be forgotten because no one's perfect. I feel like right now everyone is so on top of each other. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Purity test on both sides. And if you don't pass the purity test, you can't just be – but there will be no redemption. You are done. You are banished.
Exactly.
I had a very negative reaction to your saying no one is perfect.
This is table.
There is an exception.
Yes,
you're right, Mr. Lear. I stand.
It is. We can agree. It is hard to be a human being.
Yeah.
I don't care who or you are, or how you are. It's harder for some. You know, it's visible to the naked eye. Much, much, much harder. But it's hard to be any human being. Hmm. And I think that's in a sense the glory too.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
so complicated.
But like that's great. I agree, and I feel like if people just know that, then they can have generosity and can breathe. And because it's hard, it's not easy to get up every day, and you don't know what's going to lies ahead of you. And there's the good times and the bad times, and we're navigating all this stuff. And, you know, you mentioned that like the LGBT. Q movement, I think one of the things why it worked so well was because it really was about inclusion. even with people that were didn't understand it or were anti it, it was about bringing people in. Sometimes, you know, screaming and shouting, but it wasn't about pushing people out and eviscerating them for not agreeing or understanding it. It was like, okay. And they, you know, when they – and it's been referenced in regard to what's happening now. That was a movement that was very – that worked, that got people to other people who were not gay to stand with it because, like, oh, okay, we're going to be – the gay leaders and the LGBT community, no matter who, we're going to bring people in. Say, listen to us, but be a part of it. Not like get the, you know, F away from it. But it's hard to be human. I agree. And it's also great.
It's what it is.
Those are the forces I was talking about.
I mean, it's awesome.
It's great. The fact is, I love thinking about this. I love saying this. The fact is, it has taken me 95 years, some months, some weeks, some days, just to see you take a sip of water. Wow. Across the table from me, Bruce just lifted a bottle of gold, just took a sip. It's taken me every split second of my life. It's longer now to talk about it.
Wow, it's amazing when you put it like that.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah. For all of us at whatever age.
Right. And it's really beautiful if you look at the world through your eyes and that point of view. It took me this long to see you do that.
Yeah. Yes.
I might not even know you. You're standing at a corner and you brushed your hair aside from your face, and that is a great way. You kind of just blew my mind. Oh my God. I'm like on LSD right now.
Ayahuasca.
Norman does that. He'll do
that
too.
And I like to think about this too. Given what we know about the size and scope of the Creator's enterprise here, this being a planet among a billion in a universe among a billion or billions or whatever, given the size and scope of all of that, can you measure the difference of the impact between the guy you saw brushing his hair and Jonas Salk? So he cured polio. Yeah,
right.
And the other guy brushed his hair.
Right.
You know, but in a great scheme of things,
right,
we all matter.
Yeah.
We all matter.
Yeah.
So, positive folks, message. Vote.
Yeah. Vote and vote. All of the above.
Vote. Yes. Vote.
Can we get a recipe real quick?
Yeah, sure. What would you like?
I don't know. Just something.
I've never heard an oral like recipe.
Yeah,
like
I think this is, we're breaking new ground.
Right, should we do a hollow one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hollow. Just made hollow today.
Yeah.
So we need, do you want actual amounts? We can't give the however actual amounts out.
However defer, you want. Get a pen and paper out, everybody at home.
All right.
So however you like.
All right. So we need to have the all-purpose flour that we sift, and then we fold in the sugar, the butter, and then whip it up. And then while we're doing that, we have the yeast rising with sugar and warm water. Then mix that all together. Add the white chocolate chips at the end. Take it out, or milk chocolate, whatever you want, or for grandma we could do
green chocolate chip
for St. Patty's Day. Take it out and then you let it rise for about an hour and a half. Cut them into the three coils, roll it out, braid it, then proof it for about another 40 minutes, and then bake it for 350 degrees at 375 for about 40 minutes. Then you have to let it cool for about an hour and a half and then package or enjoy right away. It apart when it comes out.
Now, folks, when we say all of the above, we really mean all of the above. I mean, is there anybody listening to this that would have imagined they would hear the recipe for challah
with green chocolate chips
from the Challah King?
The Challah King, ladies and gentlemen.
That is hysterical.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was great. This has all been great. And this has been all of the above with all of the people I'm looking at around this table.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you,
Chris.
Thank you,
Paul. Thank
you so much.
Good night, you all.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at TheNormanLear,
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gibb.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
Hi, I'm Spencer Raskoff, the CEO of Zillow Group, and I have a new podcast here on Podcast One called Office Hours. Listen as I have one-on-one conversations with other CEOs. We have the kind of conversations that can only happen between peers, tackling tough questions, sharing hard-won insights, and helping to define what leadership means today. Join me twice a month on Office Hours, exclusively on Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and the new Podcast One app.